We don't know if we will ever have a vaccine. And if we do have a vaccine, we don't know how effective it will be. There are good reasons to suspect that if it is effective at all, it won't be completely protective, and it may not stop the epidemic. And it certainly will be difficult to vaccinate older people who need it most, because older people are very difficult to vaccinate for any problem, whether it be flu or anything else. You lose your memory for new antigens, new substances that come into your body, just as you lose your other memory, your more famous memory, as you age. It's one of the common features of aging. Anybody over 60 has a diminished immune response, and the older you get, the worse it is. Sometimes it takes 15 years or more to develop a vaccine that works for older people. Like the pneumococcal vaccine works reasonably well in older people, but it took 15 years to get it that way. It's a very tough call.
What is your advice to South Africa with its high prevalence of HIV/AIDS?
Well, what spells is a focus on public health measures. The good news about this epidemic is we know how to contain it. The Eastern Asian countries that experienced SARS took it very seriously from the very beginning. They knew not only did it have an enormous cost in human lives, but it could destroy an economy. And so from the very beginning, they took it seriously, and they did the three things that every public health official will tell you to do in an epidemic like this. Identify those who are infected, not by a test, but by symptom. Contact trace. Find out everybody who's been exposed to that person that you can possibly find for the past 10 days. And then forcibly isolate those people individually in separate facilities for 14 days past exposure. Mandatory isolation. What people talk about is testing. You don't need to test. You isolate everybody who has been exposed. You don't need to test to find out who's sick. Those people who are sick, you isolate. And those people, and you contact trace. So all of that was effective. Today, Beijing has gone more than a month without a single case. Same in Shanghai. It isn't that occasional cases don't pop up here and there, but then you do the same thing. You isolate. So you don't need a vaccine, and you don't need a drug to control it. What you need is good governance, a strong government, and a very efficient public health service.
But South African officials might say they don't have the resources that China or the West have to deal with the pandemic.
Let me clarify. It's not a problem of money. That's an excuse. South Africa, I've been many, many times to South Africa. I'm on the board of one of your institutions there. It is got plenty of money to do this kind of thing, and it's got plenty of people. It's a matter of organization and governance. And if it's not done, it's the fault of the government, and they should be held to account. Public health officials know what to do, and you can check for fever, fine. And the Chinese didn't even do that. They waited until people came into the hospital. They looked like they were sick. Then they did contact tracing. I'll tell you what happened to a friend of mine in early in the epidemic. It was very early February. He flew from Frankfurt to Shanghai. One person on the plane was sick. Everybody on that plane was contacted by the authorities and placed in a single hotel room for 14 days from the time the plane landed. They couldn't leave that room. Their meals were provided by hazmat-clad people. Their rooms were clean with hazmat-clad people. And my friend and his wife were isolated in separate rooms. No tests were ever given. You don't need the test. You just shut things down. And that is, and in the long run, it saves the economy. The Chinese economy is opening. People are walking around the streets of Beijing without masks today. So you can say that it sounds draconian, but the alternatives are far worse. That doesn't mean, as a medical researcher, I don't want to find drugs. Of course we want to find drugs. Of course we want to find vaccines. But it's a hope that we will, not a reality at this point. And the more I look at the vaccine situation, the dicier it gets. You know, all this premature announcement that we've got a vaccine that works shows that most of the vaccines, all of the ones that you've heard about, don't stop the infection. They may lessen the impact of the infection, but a vaccine should stop the infection. These don't. So people are scaling back their hopes even for that. And in this particular disease, we don't know what kind of effect. So why count on something to protect a population when you know very well you can do it without it, and you can do it at a reasonably low cost?
South Africa had a severe lockdown, but that has not really flattened the curve. And how do you deal with densely populated townships where people can't really self-isolate?
It's the same advice. Treat every human being equally. Don't discriminate based on economic income. And make a special effort on those areas that are traditionally underserved. The lesson for that comes from Singapore. Singapore is famous for efficient government, for very high quality knowledge, and for a well-educated population. They didn't treat their underserved minorities as if they were human beings. And they don't treat them that way for many other reasons. They don't pay them well. They house them in miserable conditions. They don't allow them to stay there. And they forgot about them. Guess what? The infection popped up and they had to close their entire country again, because they left out a population as if they weren't human. That's a lesson for any country. Pay most attention to your most underserved populations, those that are in the slums, those that are crowded together in the semi-autonomous regions. Those are really important things to think about.
How well do you think South Africa responded to the pandemic?
I think they've taken it much more seriously than many. I had actually, in the days of AIDS, since you bring that up, and had two face-to-face meetings with Mbeki, warning him about his misguided policies. I have to say one thing for him. He listened. He didn't do anything about it, but he did listen. And I think South Africa has learned a painful lesson, that these diseases can not only have a human cost, they can destroy an economy, and they can destroy a country's future. And I think that South Africa, more than many other countries, has taken this quite seriously. But that doesn't mean they've taken all the necessary steps. Don't count on a vaccine to save you. Count on yourself to save yourself. And it's not that expensive.
There are economists who say, but isolations and lockdowns lead to bigger economic problems, and people can't earn a living with lockdown. How do you go about protecting jobs?
What you do is what I just said, is you contact trace and isolate. You don't necessarily have to isolate everybody. When the virus is established, you have to severely constrain people's contacts. No big group meetings, people wear masks. You have to be very careful about that for the first phase. And during that phase, you have to be very, very rigorous in your contact tracing. And the follow-up, and that's what we don't do in the U.S., you ask yourself, why is a country like the U.S., the epicenter of the epidemic, the global pandemic? Why are we 5% or 4% of the world population, 30% of all the disease? That's changing slowly as other countries that mess up, like Russia, Belarus, Brazil, are also. But we've messed up terribly. It isn't that we don't have knowledge. It's that we have very poor governance. And what we didn't do is we didn't enforce contact tracing and mandatory isolation. Even at this stage, when we know everything there is to know about this out of control, we're not doing anything for mandatory isolation for those people who are exposed. And so what do? In East Asia, they climbed up a peak and right back down the other side. And now they continue with a few sporadic infections. What we did is we climbed up a peak, self-isolated, got to a plateau that's seemingly endless. And what is that going to do to our economy? As we begin to have people flood back in a city which has a high rate of infection, you're going to just drive it up again. So the level of the plateau will rise. Right now, we're at about 25,000 people a day getting sick. Okay? 25,000 people are getting sick per day in the United States. What are we willing to tolerate? 50,000? 100,000? 200,000? There's some number we won't tolerate. But right now, we seem to be tolerating 25,000 a day. And of that, about 1 to 2% die, maybe a little higher. That's a pretty high rate. We're nearing 100,000 people dead right now and eyeing 200,000 dead. That's not a happy picture, and South Africa will be doing the same if it doesn't follow the same kind of process. Yes, we're hopeful for a vaccine, but hope is not a strategy in real everyday life. Just like the doctors who are treating the patients, they have to work with what they have, not what they hope they will have.
And do treatments provide any hope?
We're getting much better as a world at learning how to treat and prevent people from dying. We're, for example, learning that if somebody is seriously ill, you've got to treat them with anticoagulants. Because in addition to attacking the lung, the virus is causing the blood to clot. And when there was a recent report, for example, when you look at the autopsies of people who've died of this disease, what people thought was pneumonia turned out to have lungs filled with tiny blood clots. So we can save, instead of a 90% death rate, if you intubated a patient, you could drop that down maybe to 30% or lower. We're learning how to manage the ventilation a lot better. We're learning to understand what patients should be in the hospital, what aren't. We're understanding that this virus directly attacks the kidney. So we have to be prepared for dialysis for some patients. We're beginning to understand that there's a very late effect in young people, not just children, young people under 30 and younger, that can show up several weeks after you already look like you're cured. And that you've got to be very careful because that can cause a rapid onset heart failure. And it shows up as a rash. It shows up as a conjunctivitis. There's a whole series it shows up of, and that's so we're learning. And we're sharing that knowledge very widely and quickly. So doctors are learning how to manage it so fatalities are reduced. And that's without any really new drugs, except for the traditional drugs that are on the shelf. There's a group in Hong Kong that's come up with a cocktail that can make a real difference to the survival of people. There are a lot of dodgy announcements, like hydroxychloroquine, or I believe it'll turn out that remdesivir is dodgy. Okay, that top U.S. health officials described it as a very modest effect. Think of Tamiflu, but a little weaker. And you probably have it about right for that drug. But the Hong Kong team has come up with a cocktail that if people are hospital with mild to moderate disease, it can save lives. Cocktail of four generic drugs that you don't have to, like remdesivir, use intravenous injection. You can either swallow the pills or have a intramuscular or subcutaneous shot. And we're learning. We're getting better. And over time, we will get better. But we've already learned the fundamental lesson. To control this infection, to save your people and to save your economy, you don't need new drugs. You need an efficient, effective public health service.
You have an equation for how infectious the world around you is. Could you share that with us, please?
Yeah, the equation is what people want to know is how likely I am to get infected. This is for an inside, when you're in a space with other people. Outside, you maybe divide the whole thing by a factor of 10, right? But the probability of getting infected is the time you're in a space with another human being divided by the distance. So the longer the distance, the lower the chance, times the number of people in a room. So the more people, the more chance somebody's going to be infected, times the number of people without face masks, because that's a higher probability of getting infected. So it's a very simple equation. Look around how many people are in the room. Look around how many are wearing face masks. There's some people in the room and they're no face masks, get out. If there's some people in the room with face masks, you can stay a little bit, but then get out. And the more people in the room, the faster you leave. Those are very simple rules for people.
What does it mean for big sporting events in the world in the next phase of the lifting of lockdowns?
Very bad for big sporting events. Unless you're willing to have them and somebody can figure out the economics. So they work with about one quarter of the people. You have a big outdoor stadium, very sparsely populated with people. You can observe a game. But is that economically feasible? I don't know. You'll have to ask them. I had a conversation with one of the top guys. Let's say, think of Ticketmaster. I don't think it was Ticketmaster, but basically that's their business, selling tickets to sporting events, concerts. And they can't make money unless there are 50 or 60,000 people there, right?
Yeah.
Well, their business is gone, and is gone for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you can't make it. There's another consideration. It's for the players. You know, a lot of players have been infected. Famous players. In every sport, every place around the world, they've been infected. And what happens in team sports, especially contact teams? Think about a rugby scrum where one of those guys is infected.
Mm.
Would you like to be playing rugby with one of those guys?
No.
I don't think so. Or look how American football is played. I mean, it is a brutal sport. It's like 100 wrestling matches at once. Without, you know, it's really what it's like. Those guys are really, they're not just, you know, bouncing off each other. They're looking at them sometimes. It's a very, right, it's like individual scrums going on all the time. It's a tough sport. Basketball, look at basketball. Just look at the sweat that pours off these athletes and the way they have to breathe. My goodness. Whether it's basketball, like, or maybe, you know, the more genteel sports like baseball and cricket are kind of different. There's not a lot of contact there.
Yeah.
But there's people huddled in the team shelters, and you got to figure out what to do for that. So even those are complicated, play without fans. Maybe ping pong.
Well, yeah, no spectators, though. What does the future look like? I mean, are we going to sit with coronavirus, the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, for some time in the future?
Well, you know, I think at this point, the bet are yes. And the reason for that is humans have a history with coronavirus. It's probably with us. They've been with us for a very long time. We only knew about it from the 60s. But right now, we know that there have been four coronaviruses, a couple from bats and from cows and other species. In fact, coronaviruses are in many mammals, including really odd mammals. And they come into the human population at some point. And once they establish themselves, they have a very peculiar habit. Now, everybody understands the flu comes back seasonally. It's a little different from the time before. So your immune system that's seen it one time doesn't see the new one. So it's like putting on a mustache and a beard. It comes in a different disguise, so you don't recognize it. Well, these viruses are different. They knock you down, give you a cold, and they come back looking exactly the same and give you another cold. And the next year, they do it again. And the next year, they do it again. And they've been doing it, same four characters, as long as we've watched them for the past 50 years. This kind of virus doesn't need to change. It has a bunch of tricks to fool your immune system, so it's never seen it before. And some of those tricks are very difficult for vaccines. That's why I'm more skeptical about a vaccine. I don't think, I'm not going to say it won't happen, but it's going to be tough because one of its tricks is it infects you, your immune system recognizes, gets rid of it, and then forgets about it. So this virus has ways of making your immune system forget. Second thing is it often comes in through the nose. And the nasal route is one of the hardest, most difficult problems in vaccinology. It hasn't ever been solved, actually. How do you protect somebody from a virus that comes in through your nose? And people are trying, but they haven't cracked the problem. Problem number two. Problem number three is the people who need it the most are older people, and they are the weakest. And not only are they the weakest, they react to the virus most violently. Because when your immune system gets weak as you get older, one part of it, another part gets stronger to help you protect you. That's called natural innate immunity. Well, what does that do? When a virus comes in, it says, we can't remember what we've seen, but we're going to be more active than normal to get rid of this thing. And that's what kills a lot of people. It's an overactive immune system. So there are a lot of difficulties with this. So the short answer to your question, it's going to be around. Maybe for decades, maybe for centuries.
So we have to learn to live with it and cope with it.
Exactly. And control it through public health measures. And hopefully, I'm also very hopeful, more hopeful, that we're going to have effective drugs. We'll have drugs that knock out this virus. We'll have drugs that provide immunity. These are drugs, not vaccines, for a period of time, say up to 4 months per shot, for our healthcare workers. We are going to have them. I'm almost certain. And we'll have a drug, a pill that you can take the moment you think you're getting sick that can stop it cold. And some of those same pills may again be used by healthcare workers. So we will adapt. We are a clever species. We'll adapt. This virus has cracked our code. It's time for us to crack its code.
You have established dozens of biotech companies. What is the impact of COVID-19 on the biotech and medtech sectors? Just the last short one, please.
It's been great for them. The one sector, if you look at it, done terrifically well, is biotech and medtech companies. They've done very well.